morning and welcome. It's Ask the Pastor on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. KFUO is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for joining us. Thanks again to Pastor Ken Wagner, and apologies for the difficulties with the phone lines, but as Buzz says, these things happen, and we just work around them as best we can. But now, with very special fanfare,
Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
And, of course, that very special salutation means that the Reverend Dr. Martin Noland is joining us again for Ask the Pastor. How are you, my friend? Good to have you back on the program.
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
I just dance around the room whenever I hear that.
Yeah, I do, too.
Not just because it's good music, but it's a delight to have you back on the program. Thanks for being so gracious with your time with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Though it is a very sad day, isn't it?
What's today?
Oh, it's such a sad, such bad news coming. You know, it's not coming out of the Middle East, though that's very sad. It's not coming out of the economic quarters. Well, it kind of is in a sense, but the death of Hostess.
Oh, yes.
No more Twinkies.
Yes.
No more ding-dongs. No more ho-hos. No more snowballs.
Well, they said that they might find another buyer for them. I mean, I'm sure that somebody...
Oh, they just do that to taunt us.
Oh, that could be, but...
I mean, this is iconic from your and my... We're about the same age, Dr. Nolan. This is iconic from your and my youth, and now it's gone.
Every child knew that they were special if when they opened up their lunchbox, remember lunchboxes?
Oh, yeah, I do.
When you opened up your lunchbox and there was a Hostess Twinkie or a Ding Dong,
yeah.
And all the other children just, they envied and they begged and they pleaded. But usually,
yes.
And that one person, that maybe sometimes just one kid in the class that had the Twinkie, they would put them in their mouth and roll their eyes, how good it was. You remember those days?
Oh, yeah. And you were king. You were king of the lunch table because if you had a cupcake or a Twinkie, they would trade you anything to get that away from you.
And if Reese's followed, you could bargain to be first in line on the up the bat. And, sorts of things that went on with that.
Look at that. Even in the lunchroom, you learn about things coming out of the capitalist system.
That's true. Yeah. And you know, young romantic relationships and, in middle grades were even broken or started because of such things.
I don't know. I didn't adventure into that until I got to college.
I saw it happening.
I married the first girl who said yes.
Okay.
And it took me until college to find her. But it is kind of a sad day. I should, by way of proper introduction, we always have a bit of fun with that special anthem for Dr. Noland. But the Reverend Dr. Martin Noland is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. And, I don't know what to make of this. You know, the thing about St. Louis right now, and you spend a lot of time here in the St. Louis area, you go to the St. Louis Zoo, and I want to show my kids what I saw when I was their age. It's all gone. It's all been redeveloped.
Oh,
and
really?
It's all changed. Yeah, it's not really the same place anymore.
Oh.
You know, a lot of those special places like Giegrich Pretzel Company and all that. You know, this world is changing, and it's starting to get to be a little bit depressing.
Well, my kids love the St. Louis Zoo, and we've lived in a couple of different places already since they've been born, and that's their favorite zoo. Partly it's our favorite because it's free, except for the parking.
but
you can walk in and see a whole lot of the zoo, and really a whole day's worth, without having to pay a thing. But, you have to keep saying no every time you walk by, stands. Yeah.
But there's something charming, though, about... being able to take your daughter when she's, or your son when they're 4 or 5 years old, to the same spots where your grandmother, your grandfather
That's
took you.
True.
And those are all sort of, changed. Because, there's a whole philosophy of change when it comes to how you build a zoo and how you keep these animals. Because we have to be, it's almost as if we have to treat them like they're equals to us.
Well, I think there is a sense that, they can find out how certain type of animals are happy or unhappy. And part of it is their ability to propagate, and so they found, for example, they really want pandas to propagate and produce baby pandas, but boy, is that hard. I mean, they've got to do just everything just right, And I guess the Chinese are the only ones that really got it figured out. Fresh bamboo must be the key, I'm not sure. But so, it really is, you know, you can tell an animal that is being well taken care of. Certainly, you know, domestic animals, dogs and cats, you can tell one. We've got a member of our congregation that is a almost full-time volunteer for the Humane Society in Evansville. And I've gone over to her place with my kids, and she's taught us a lot about, you know, really taking care of animals. And the sad thing is that, you know, private owners of animals really do often mistreat their animals, which is really a sad thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I think in some sense the greater care that's going into that, but you know there is some of it too that just kind of show too. So I have to admit, you know, not everything is good that's new.
Well, you know, when you say that, you know, how well they propagate is a sign of how happy they are.
Yeah.
I have only two kids. What does that say?
Don't tell your wife. Don't tell your wife I said that.
Yeah, I can't help. I just noticed these things. Hey, I've got a bit of audio I want to start you out with here. This is interesting. You know how people today sort of think going to church is drudgery?
Yeah.
That it's almost like a prison sentence to have to sit in church for an hour? Well, here's a story where someone quite literally has turned church into a prison sentence. Listen to this.
Sentenced to 10 years of church.
Yeah, perhaps that's the result of praying for leniency. In any case, an area judge says he hopes to make a difference in a teen's life. 17-year-old Tyler Allred of Muskogee pleaded guilty to first-degree manslaughter. He caused a car accident in which another teen, his passenger, died last December. Fox 23's Dante Carter explains what one local pastor says must happen for this unconventional sentence to work.
I can tell you Muskogee County judges are getting creative with their sentencing. Instead of spending time in the big house, he'll be spending time with the big man.
Our judicial system is beginning to see that not always is the solution to lock someone up.
If you do the crime, Boulevard Christian Church pastor James McCracken believes in doing the time. But where you serve it could make the most impact.
I believe that being in a church situation puts you in an environment where you can hear things that will change your life.
He's hoping that will happen for 17-year-old Tyler Allred. Last December, Allred was behind the wheel when his truck crashed into a tree. His passenger and friend, 16-year-old John Dumb, died.
Normally change comes about when we have some event that hurts us enough that we have to make some adjustments in our lifestyle.
McCracken doesn't know Allred, but hopes the teen takes advantage of his second chance. The pastor says people can be sent to church, but real change comes with a heart change.
To give them an opportunity to learn, to change some habits, some issues within their life that is leading to a destructive lifestyle.
He helps at-risk teens across Muskogee find the right path with a class called The Landing. He's pointing those teens to God.
I think the cross is the ultimate sign of hope.
The judge and McCracken are hoping the time Allred spends in church and speaking to teens will help keep them out of here. Reporting in Muskogee, I'm Dante Carter, Fox 23 News.
Dante, thank you. The teen's punishment is a hot topic tonight. Jason from Tulsa writes, he currently goes to church. How is that a punishment then? It's like going to your room to play on your computer, Xbox, PS3, cell phone, or watch TV. But Tara says, I'm sure he probably feels bad about the accident. He will need God to help him through the process and to heal all the emotions he is feeling. I think it was a great idea.
Well, Dr. Nolan, what strikes you about that story?
Well, I don't like the idea of church being considered a sentence, a punishment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the Lutheran church, you know, the gospel predominates, which is a good thing. I mean, and I'm not... And we hope that maybe this gentleman that was convicted of this, that he would understand the gospel. You have to understand that, you know, a lot of churches in the United States, the law is the main thing. I mean, and the gospel is there, but that just kind of gets us to heaven. And that, but it really isn't all about the gospel. And so when they, in this type of situation, it demonstrates that they think that the purpose of the church is to get people to get their lives straightened out or to live a better life.
Yeah, it's a place of therapy.
Yeah, and that's just wrong. It's not what it's all about. We do know that, And the studies have been done on this, that the people that go to church or some religious organization, they tend to have, better self-discipline. They're more concerned about living in a harmonious relationship with their neighbor. They tend to avoid breaking the law. That doesn't mean that everybody that is religious is or claims to be religious has those qualities. But overall, those things tend to correlate. But from a Lutheran standpoint, really this is not what it's all about. That's a fruit. Because the main thing that we're there is first to receive the revelation of God and who He is and His love and grace for us. And that's the main thing. It's not about changing our life. Some people do need to change their life in order to live in this society. But what you need to have in order to live in God's society, that is God's kingdom, is you need to have a changed attitude, what we call repentance. They acknowledge that you are a sinner, not that you just happened to run into a tree and killed somebody, that you are always the sinner, and that you need God's grace and forgiveness in order to be saved. So this kind of sentence, I think, it puts the main reason why we have church, it puts it on the back burner instead of the front burner, and that's why I don't really care for it.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. If you want to get in by way of email, you can certainly do so. The Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan is our guest this morning. What this kind of relates to, I think, is there's another story. It comes out of the Family Research Council, and it plays off an article that was in the Washington Times. And the headline of that article was Evangelicals Struggle to Stay Relevant in Republican Politics. And the question that arises then is, are stories like these, that type of church, or just churches in general in America, trying to find some place where they can just stand out as still being relevant?
It could be. I don't want to judge the judge in the decision.
Okay.
Because you don't know this family, which he might. You don't know the individual involved, and maybe he's trying to do some creative prosecution here, which sometimes has an effect if he knows the individual involved. And when you deal with juveniles, it's a different situation with adults, because you always hope. There's always hope, because a person does not set in their ways until a little bit later in life, that in a juvenile case you can get some reform and change. So I think that's in that sense, it's a good thing. But question about the relevancy of Christianity, it's always relevant. There's no doubt about that. It deals with our, certainly with our eternal salvation. It also deals with how we can cope with the issues that we deal with in life. It gives purpose and meaning to our life. And I don't know how people that don't have a religion, what they're doing. You know, they're just kind of wandering around. The latest, greatest thing that appears, that's what they go after. They have no guiding star, as it were, in their life. People that have a religion have some purpose, and they know where they're going, even if they're not sure about their eternal salvation. Christians, on the other hand, we have a certainty about our eternal salvation and what will happen to us when we die. And that's the great appeal of the church. But in respect, is it relevant to politics? That's the question you brought up with family religion?
The Family Research Council has a fellow by the name of Nathan Oppmann has written a piece called Are Christians Relevant? And ultimately, his answer is yes, because, the gospel is true and clear, and we will always be relevant because of that. But what he's looking at is this phenomenon that's come out of evangelical Christianity, where they really seem to have wedded themselves to political success as an affirmation of their faith. And now that Mitt Romney has lost, there's sort of this navel-gazing about what happened. I thought we were faithful. Didn't we pray hard enough?
Oh, yeah.
And that sort of thing.
Now, is that the group that there was like a bombing at their headquarters?
No, it was the fellow who walked in and shot the guard at the front door. They're in Washington, D.C. They're a pro-traditional marriage. They're pro,
right.
A conservative organization. And this guy walked in carrying a bag full of Chick-fil-A and a gun and shot the guard at the front door.
So this is the organization you're quoting from then?
Right, exactly, yeah.
So then, and then obviously that organization is very concerned about the influence. I think it's more better to say the influence of Christians, because we're always relevant. Any religion is relevant if you believe in it.
Right.
So, but I think he's really concerned, his organization, whether it's going to keep going, you know, because if there's a disconnect and if Christians don't support his organization or political parties as a bloc, as a voting bloc, well, then his type of organization goes out of business. But I think that is a good question. You know, what is, you know, should Christians, should any religious group have influence in the political process? And if so, what should that be? I think that's always a relevant topic. And that, it's like you got two of the hottest topics that you generally avoid in polite conversation. You put them together to one, you're going to have a lot of people arguing. And so I think it's you have to treat it carefully because you don't want to step on people's toes. But I think it's I think it is a good question, and the issue is going to come out different for each religious tradition, because each one of us, each one of the different religious traditions, let's say Roman Catholic, or the Puritans, or the Anglicans, or the Lutherans, or the Anabaptists, those are like some of the major groups that have fed into the United States that are Christian. Those all have a different answer to that question. Each one has its own unique answer. So, for example, the Amish people, which are they're derived from the Anabaptists in the 16th century, their answer is, oh, there's no connection, and the church, that is the community of believers, should be completely separate from society as much as that's possible. And they're not interested in influencing politics at all. Whereas the history of the Roman Catholic Church, going back certainly in the medieval period, there was a constant fight, certainly from the time of Gregory the Great, over the the role of the church through its head officers, through the bishops, the archbishops, archabbots, and the and certainly the Pope. What was their power with respect to the kings and the emperor and the laws of the land? And traditionally, in the late medieval period, at the height of it, it would be Innocent III, who was no innocent pope. He was the ruler of all of you know, what we would consider Europe and its connected connected territories. In that time, he was the, you know, he could put down kings easily. So, and of course, the American Catholics today don't believe in that, but that's the tradition. So then, you know, they're not going to just sit down and say we're not going to have any influence at all. That would not be according to the Catholic tradition. So you have to look at each faith tradition and say what is their dominant approach to that question. And so, but it is a very significant question. I think people are reanalyzing that today, especially evangelicals, because American evangelicals have been so involved politically, especially since the 70s.
Well, let's separate out the politics from the word relevant for a moment, because this is a discussion even in Lutheran circles. What does it mean to be relevant to culture? Is that even a discussion the church should be having? Should we just assume that we are and move forward, or is this a good thing to discuss?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it can often be a tool by which a person that's trying to argue for a certain position will say, your way of thinking about religion or your way of doing church is not relevant
exactly
to a certain group of people. And that is, it's an argument. It's, you know, they're trying to get you to think things their way or to do things their way. And so you have to meet the argument and dissect it and say, you know, is it really true? You just can't accept that at face value and say, oh, well, you say it's irrelevant, therefore it is. No, it's, and the reason that historic Christianity, and as we express it in our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is always relevant. I like to use the word perennial, like you have a flower in your backyard that comes back every year. That's a perennial. It's the same spelling, the same meaning. It's always relevant because the revelation we've received from God, on which basis we have the doctrines that we teach our catechism kids and from which the pastors preach on Sunday, that revelation is from God. And unless God has said, I'm going to change my mind, it's always relevant. It was intended to be that way. And so the it's not irrelevant just because humanity has changed its outlook or its technology or its sciences. One way of looking at it is that humanity is beginning to figure out what God has already known from the beginning of the universe when you talk about scientific principles. It's not like God has changed his mind. He's just kind of sitting back and say, okay, I kind of knew that about, again, all this before the foundation of the world. He says, boy, you guys are awfully slow, So it's not like, but see, then that's part of it. The issue is that after the period of rationalism in European and then American thought, rationalism thought we could come to understand God and science purely through reason without looking at the scriptures at all, and they soon found out that there were a lot of holes in that idea. And then they came up with a more sophisticated idea, was that we still don't need the Bible to understand God, but what they figured out, or they thought they figured out, is that God kind of moves along with mankind. So this is expressed particularly by Hegel, but it really is the whole 19th century idea, is that God begins, God learns himself about how things work as we figure things out. And so that means that whatever God revealed to the Jews, well, of course, that's ridiculous, because God has moved on with the rest of us. And so the idea of the irrelevancy of the scriptural revelation, it's definitely a 19th century and 20th century product. And, people may use that argument not knowing where it came from, but that's what it's based on, is the idea that God does change and God is learning things, and what he told the Jews, well, that's irrelevant today. So, for example, do not murder. Well, that's irrelevant today, of course. This is the type of arguments that they will give. And they won't go to that extent, because everybody with any sort of common sense knows that it's wrong to murder people. But then they'll, any of the other commands in the Old or New Testament, they'll say, oh, that isn't really, really valid.
Let's grab a quick phone call, Dr. Noland, before we go to the break. We've got a minute and a half. Bill, can you get your question in real quick?
Okay, I've got a couple questions. The questions have to do with baptism. I've got this thing that was a part of the Catholic Church rites on baptism, and it refers to the fact that in their rite of baptism, as they call it, they our sacrament, of course, they use salt, and they put the salt in the baby's nostrils or under the tongue or something, and they use salt as part of the baptismal, I don't know how they say it. Yeah, the baptismal, sacrament. And another thing I was going to ask real quick is, I read where somewhere, or heard somewhere, where the early Christians, they got into all kinds of rituals with baptism. They'd use milk on people. I don't know whether that was because there was a shortage of water or something. And the idea of being nude, of when you're being baptized, wouldn't that kind of affect people as far as maybe the sixth commandment about committing adultery? It was kind of a, people naked around other people being baptized. I'll hang up and see what you have to say about that. Okay, thank you.
All right, Bill, a couple of interesting questions.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Noland, hang on. Okay. We'll get to those right after we get back from this break. Because, well, with only 15 seconds, you couldn't possibly cover all that. The Reverend Dr. Martin Noland is our guest this morning. He serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. And when we get back, two questions about salt and how the early Christians did baptism. Stick around. We'll be right back after these few short messages.
KFUO, the messenger of good news, broadcasting 24 hours a day at KFUO.org.
I'm a regular listener, I have been for many years. I just want to compliment you and also Roland at the Bible study and the Ask the Pastor programs. I look forward to hearing them every day, and my faith grows, and it's good hearing from the other pastors he interviews, and also his program on Saturday afternoons as well. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you guys for KFUO, some of the best talk radio.
Listeners from all over the world can follow the ministry of KFUO via our website, Facebook, Wi-Fi radios, and smartphone apps.
I'm a KFUO supporter, and I really enjoy all the archives. I love the long gospel program and the Bible study. I like the book talk also. It's good. Thank you.
You can listen to KFUO radio 24 hours a day, anywhere, with our on-demand programs and live audio streams. KFUO, the messenger of good news.
You may know Thrivent Financial for Lutherans as a Fortune 500 organization, but did you know we're committed to excellence in financial services and caring for others? That's why we're proud to support the St. Louis area and those who live here. Find out more about the unique ways we give back to the communities we serve. In Chesterfield, call me, Matthew Kloss, at 314-783-4213. That's 314-783-4213.
Courtesy of the Thanksgiving holiday, this week on His Time will be a short one. We'll discuss Christians as salt and light in the theater arts. We'll ponder Thanksgiving according to the scriptures. And we'll hear about mission work in Peru. After that, we pray that you will have a safe and blessed Thanksgiving holiday with family and friends. And that's from your friends here at His Time.
Weekday mornings beginning at 7 a.m. on KFUO.
An organization representing atheists and agnostics is suing the Internal Revenue Service.
The IRS inexplicably seems to be ignoring blatant electioneering by pastors and priests and churches and organized campaigns.
Annie Laurie Gaylor is with the Freedom from Religion Foundation. A national coalition of faith groups and homeless advocates has called on Congress to fund the National Housing Trust Fund to the tune of $1 billion. Participants included the National Councils of Churches and Catholic Charities USA.
It's not okay to be in the richest country in the world and have people living on the streets.
Rabbi Steve Guto is with the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which is also participating. A judge in Muskogee, Oklahoma, sentenced a teen to attend church for 10 years as part of his probation for a manslaughter conviction. Tyler Allred pleaded guilty to first-degree manslaughter for an auto accident last year that killed another teen. His lawyer calls the church requirement unusual, but says his 17-year-old client already attends church regularly. I'm Norman Hall.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Physician-assisted suicide's been legal in Oregon for 5 years, so the Center for Ethics and Health Care at Oregon Health and Science University did some research to see how things were going for the patients involved. The results were published in the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association. What they found is shocking and should change the way many people feel about euthanasia. The research shows 90% of patients who asked their doctors for help in killing themselves changed their minds and chose to live. It turns out their biggest fear when first requesting the lethal prescription was pain. Later, they found out their pain could be managed and decided not to end it all. This clearly shows we need to provide basic comfort care to terminal patients, not death.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Welcome back to Ask the Pastor. Our guest this morning, as you can already tell from that very special theme, is the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan, who, as we went to the break, was left with two really intriguing questions here, Dr. Nolan, about the use of salt in the baptismal rites of the Roman Church and how early Christians had some, I don't know, maybe some strange practices related to baptism.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Doesn't usually come up, and Bill there must be reading around or finding some interesting sources. Actually, the use of salt was in the Old Testament for every offering. That's in Leviticus 2:13. It was also used by the Romans and the Greeks. And then apparently this was what Bill talked about, putting salt in a baby's nostril at the time of baptism, was a custom of the pagan Romans, not the church. The pagan Romans placed a few grains of salt on the lips of an infant on the eighth day after his birth to chase away the demons. And so historians believe that that Roman practice of putting the grains of salt on the lips lay behind the offering of blessed salt to catechumens, which was formerly part of the Roman Catholic rite of baptism. However, as far as I know, that in the revised versions of the Roman Catholic rites, they no longer do that. When they change that, I'm not sure. So I think Bill's referring to an old practice with regard to salt. The question about nudity, I do believe that the Eastern Orthodox churches, and I've seen pictures of, for example, Russian Orthodox baptisms, in the case of infants, they are baptized as they come from birth without any clothes or robes or anything like that. And they're usually, I believe, fully immersed in a rather large font. Baptism of, I don't think there's ever been a history, perhaps some sectarians, but of any of the normal churches, that they would baptize adults in the nude. I've never seen evidence of that.
Well, and you're from California, so you would know.
Yeah, well, you know, actually there is a little bit of history on that. The Calvary Chapel, which has branches or congregations all around the United States, they kind of got their name in the newspapers down in L.A., that's Los Angeles, by they did their baptisms down at the beach. And so, you know, well, that sounds pretty cool. So, you know, they got there regularly. They would have some type of news on the TV or newspaper, and that's one of the reasons they got attention and built their church so big. But, of course, most people don't baptize on the beach because it's impractical, and if you don't watch, you'll float out to sea with the tides. There's also white sharks to worry about. So, but anyway, there was a concern in the early church about the because the normal outfit would be a very basic, like a sheet or a tunic, and that the baptism of women, they wouldn't be totally nude, but they just have, you know, a simple sheet, that this would be immodest. And so that was one of the reasons that baptism was done with the office of deaconess, so that the women being baptized, there wouldn't be any offense or immodesty with that. So I think Bill has probably picked up some incorrect information, at least some information I've never seen that's reliable. And I think he mentioned milk. Now, that refers not to baptism, but in the early church, maybe the first couple of centuries, we have preserved some of the liturgies for the Eucharist, that's for the Lord's Supper. And as part of the liturgy, they had the bringing forward of the bread and the wine. But in some of the liturgies, they also had a bringing forth milk and honey. Why they did that, I don't know. I don't know if anybody's been able to figure out why they did it. But they in the Lutheran service, our liturgy that we would have today, this would happen after the pastor finishes his sermon. We normally have the giving of the offerings. That is, people, you know, they give their envelope or their money, and the ushers collect that. In some churches, that's brought forward to the altar, and it's put on the altar. Well, in the early church, the gifts would be tangible gifts in the form of not just money, but also bread and wine, which would then be consumed in the sacrament, but then also milk and honey. And I don't know if the milk and honey was blessed or eaten, but they did not confuse the milk and honey with the bread and wine, but it was used, and that's probably what Bill's referring to.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and KFUO at KFUO.org. I have a handy-dandy little app on my iPad, which is sort of this day in history, one of several ones that are out there. And I noticed that one of the things it says here is that today, on this day in 534, the Codex Justinianus was finally published, which I think ultimately became what we know as canon law. The Justinian I, Eastern Roman Emperor, sort of wanted some standardized civil law, I guess, and it was kind of lost on Europe and then rediscovered, I guess, in Italy and then brought back up again. I don't know if that has any interest for you, Dr. Nolan, or not, but I thought it was kind of a novelty that, you know, we don't really stop and think about from where we get things like liturgy or law or whatever.
Oh, the code, you're talking about the Code of Justinian.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's very significant in the history of law. That would be, I don't remember, is that in the Christian era or not?
Justinian the First.
You said 534, is
534,
that correct?
Yeah. That's when the second and final version was published, which became, I guess, sort of the standard version.
Oh, I know, because I always get the two. There was a code that was passed by Diocletian.
Right.
And that was earlier, still under pagan Rome. So the code, Justinian code, what that would be the Christianization of the law of the Roman Empire. So that's why it is significant. And it was this day, is that what you say?
Yeah, it was on this day.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so, and it just got me to thinking about how we tend not to really pay attention to from where things come, and perhaps that's why we get into these debates about things like, you know, what is liturgical practice or liturgical music or how we do baptisms. And do you think, with a better rendering and better understanding of our history, these questions really wouldn't be as hot as they are today?
It is helpful. I mean, that's the reason we study history and church history, is to clarify disagreements and debates that happen in the church today. So for that reason, the study of church history and general history is always useful. It's always relevant. You know, some people are, as my daughter told me this morning, she says, "I hate history." She has a quiz today, and I'm afraid she wasn't ready for it. And I said, well, I've told her this previous. I said, you know, at the high school level, a lot of what you're doing is just assembling a bunch of facts into your head so you can have an intelligent conversation. In her case, it's American history. And so, you know, they're talking about the Battle of Gettysburg and why did they have that and who won and why did that happen. If you're going to have an intelligent conversation about the history of the United States, you've got to know some of those facts, and they just have to be memorized.
Well, the problem, and I've had some experience with this the last couple of days, something I won't get into, but, you know, history is times and dates and places. But discerning what those events mean for the bigger picture tends to be more about philosophy. I mean, for example, if you happen to be in Dresden while it's being firebombed, you have one perspective on right and wrong, and if you're the guy in the bomber dropping the bombs, you have a different perspective, and that's really more about philosophy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and in case of Dresden, I am sure that the bombers, after they saw what had happened, many of them felt, you know, a sense of remorse and regret. Mm-hmm. It's not that all soldiers are intent on causing suffering on their fellow man. And certainly the people in Dresden, they really got it. The history does, Luther talks about history in a couple of his prefaces. I think they're in the volumes on Christian and Society. And I think it's a Capella. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, he shows that we learn about, we actually learn more about how to live our life today in government, in business, and in the church by looking at the examples that are supplied by history. So even though history does not repeat itself, certainly not exactly, there are many stories that we have from history that can teach us about things that we should avoid or things that we should emulate. And this is, for Luther, the main reason that we should study history both in the church and in the general society.
Well, but I mean, when you start comparing things, historical events, that, you know, if you want to compare anything, if you want to compare Sherman's March to the Sea and his version of total war with other military engagements that come further down the road in history, you're not, I mean, it's not really apples and apples that are being compared. I'm trying to understand how, when you take the times and the dates and the names and the places and you try and figure out what they mean, how a historian does that.
Historians have the same question, you know. How do you, there's a bunch of things that historians do, just like any discipline or any job. You have to acquire a bunch of different tools, you have to acquire a bunch of different facts, and you've got to be able to use them in a somewhat reasonable way, and the uses of history are many. It's not just what, you know, what Luther emphasized was emulation or avoidance of bad examples. But the question is, you know, what is the best use of history, and is this, in a particular case, is it a legitimate use? So, for example, we had in Vietnam a very unpopular war. And some people concluded from that the United States should never go to war at all. Well, does one case of an unpopular war, and you can argue the merits or demerits of it on a world, you know, a world basis, you know, was this important for world history or for keeping the peace? But does that one example then prove that, well, the United States is just, you know, we're a pushover? Well, after we pulled out of Vietnam, some countries concluded that.
Hmm.
And so, you know, they looked at the history, the recent history, and said, well, the United States, they're a pushover, and we can now carry on with what we want to do. And then that led to a furtherance of the Cold War instead of a stopping of it. And it really took until the socialist and communist countries kind of collapsed from within. You know, the Pope and Reagan wanted to take credit for a lot of that, and they, you know, they did put on pressure, but it actually was internal. You know, the promises of communism and socialism did not live up to what Marx had promised. There wasn't a utopia. In fact, things were worse.
Hmm.
The Germans across the Berlin Wall, the Easterners looked at the Westerners and said, this is not working. It has been a generation or two, and it's not working. How many generations before it starts working? And the great thing is that the Eastern Germans were the most committed to hardline communism of any of the people, and they were right opposite the West Germans, which were most committed to, you know, the capitalist approach. So you couldn't have a starker contrast. And then when John F. Kennedy came in and said, I'm a Berliner, both sides said, what does this mean? Is he with me or the other side? And it was the commitment of the United States to try to resolve that, which eventually it did. And part of that was freedom. Do you remember Radio Free Europe?
Oh, yeah. I used to listen to those broadcasts because my folks both came from East Bloc countries. They were refugees at the end of the war.
Yeah. So it shows the importance, you know, that the Russians understood the importance of propaganda and controlling the media, which they were very effective at doing, but they couldn't stop radio waves. Well, this is an advertisement for KFUO, of course. So that was a very effective way without, you know, that's why they called it a Cold War. It was a war of ideas. And they kept hammering home how great it is to live in capitalist countries where, you know, people are free to express themselves and to own their own property and build their own farms and all these other things. And eventually it eventually ground down the popular opinion in the communist countries. So all those things show that, you know, history is a complicated subject. And what often happens is people draw quick conclusions and they're facile. That is, they say, well, this one thing happened, therefore it proves that you know,
yeah.
It doesn't work like science that way. Usually there's multiple causes. And that's one of the challenges that both the scholarly historian and the popularizer historian faces, is how do you explain this in a way that's true to what really happened?
Yeah, you made reference earlier to the old joke about religion and politics. Let me tell you, if you want to get into a good fight, talk about history.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. Herman's been waiting patiently. Herman, good morning. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Mr. Lechner, it might have placated your concern about the decline of those places in St. Louis if they'd never taken up the streetcar system.
Well, it's coming back, though, in U City. That's you know, they're making a comeback with it.
Dr. Nolan, do you have insight into the accounting, mathematical accounting system that went with the system of purgatory that Luther encountered, such as, well, if you venerate this particular sacred object or relic, you get so many years out of purgatory? Who determined those values, and what was was there an upper limit on purgatory after which, if you're there for that amount of time, you automatically passed into heaven, or was that ever clear or systematized?
Well, this is an excellent question, and when we talk about it historically, we shouldn't confuse it with what is current practice today. And I can't speak to what current practice is in the Roman Catholic Church today, except that they still do believe in penance and in confession and satisfaction, the basic doctrines. But actually, you know, what is the punishment or satisfaction that's required? Well, actually, that takes us back to our first, where the judge imposes upon this young man going to church for so many years. Well, that is just like what penance was all about. So there was a number of religious works that people would have to do in order to satisfy satisfy the sins that they had committed, basically. And I think you're right that there was a limit. I think the theologians disagreed about that. You know, how many years or how long would a person stay in purgatory before they were actually released? I think that kind of went back and forth. The notion of private penance received its charter at the Fourth Lateran Council, which was 1215. And you can compare that, because that's in writing, with the new Roman Catholic rite of penance, which is, that comes in about 1973. And the system changes. It's just like the liturgy has changed in the Roman Catholic Church, and the liturgy changes in the Lutheran Church every couple of generations. That's a normal thing. Confession of sins was, though, expected to be complete. So all the sins that you knew about and the sins you didn't know about, you had to confess to the priest, and then to try base. And what they had, the priests of the time of the Reformation had a manual, because, you know, Gutenberg had a printing press, and therefore the Catholics could publish little handbooks that in the confessional booth, the priest, when he heard a particular sin and described in enough detail, he could look it up in the handbook and said, this is what's prescribed. In other words, so the priest wasn't really coming up with a penalty or punishment out of thin air. It was what was agreed upon. It was a standard punishment or penance that had to be done. And so that is part of the Reformation history that was revised and reformed by the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent. Different principles were used, and they changed some of those things at the time of Vatican II, because the Vatican II was very thoroughgoing. It went through just about everything in church life and brought it up to what they would say would be modern times.
I see. Yes, I know. Seen the movie Martin Luther, talking about if they venerate so many relics, they get like 1,900,000 years out of purgatory,
right,
reduction or thing, and it just made you wonder how. So apparently, there was a standard ascribed to those things by some authority in the Roman Catholic Church.
Right, and so again, what, you know, if they were talking about 1,000,000 years. That might have been at the time of Luther. Ever seen that figure, but that probably would have been changed at the Council of Trent. And of course, you have to understand 1,000,000 years is a minute compared to eternity. So So, you know, a million years to us sounds awfully long. But from a theological standpoint, well, it's just, it's not that long of a period. I think the best way to get a sense of how purgatory worked is to read Dante's Divine Comedy. And the first part of that is the Inferno, which Dante goes with Virgil down to hell. And the middle part is the Purgatorio, where he walks through in a slowly ascending pattern through purgatory. And then you can see by reading that how the Middle Ages understood purgatory to actually work. And so a variety of times in that middle work, Dante and Virgil walk by people that are like walking through flames, or they're going through some type of suffering, and they kind of ask, well, how long have you been doing, how long have you been here? You know, that type of thing. And so you'll get an idea how the, and this was for the popular audience, it wasn't for theologians, how they understood purgatory to actually work out in practice.
Herman, thanks for the call.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate your time. Let's jump to James. James has a question about Gregorian reforms.
Right. But first I'd like to say, hi to Pastor and ask a question about the attitudes of evangelicals.
Okay, now we have only 2.5 minutes, so we have to be quick.
Oh, okay. With the attitude of evangelicals is that society and other faiths house nominal Christians and unsaved, unethical people as a presupposition. I think then the intent of their participation in the politics and the public square is to exert their morality and social control as an influence. And so what I was going to ask you, Pastor, was do you think that this is why they feel that they're not relevant because they have a sense that they're losing the culture wars? And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about how the reason actions of the Gregorian reforms on moral integrity of the politics of that day and how they kind of correlate. And if you have a chance, say a little bit about it. Thank you.
You've got 2 minutes, Pastor.
2 minutes.
This is worse than a doctoral dissertation.
James always has the best question.
He does.
Not putting down any of your other callers, but he just thinks through things, and really it's always a pleasure to talk to any of your audience. And today we've had a couple of people that I recognize, and I recognize both Herman and James from previous discussions. But I'll just try to briefly answer the question about the evangelicals. Yeah, they're concerned about their influence, and they see themselves as kind of leaders of Christians in America. And with this recent election, they're very disturbed, because they think that this proves that politically their influence is waning. Now, I'm not an expert on politics or current issues. I'm a historian, so I can't really tell you whether this is true or not. But that is their concern. There's no doubt about it. I will say that I've kind of kept my eyes on the evangelicals since my seminary days, because they do pose a I wouldn't say a threat, but they're a competition for the hearts and minds of our Lutheran people. And I went to a conference that was sponsored or featured Francis Schaeffer, the not Frankie, that's his son, but Francis
right.
Schaeffer, and I believe it was the one dealing with abortion. And at the end of the conference, Frankie Schaeffer stood up and said, "We are going to impose our morality on the American people, all of them." And everybody in the crowd, and there must have been a couple of hundred people there, they stood up and they cheered, and they cheered for 5 minutes. And the guy I went with, he noticed that I was sitting down. And I said, "I don't agree with that. That's not what this country is all about." And Lutherans have a different way of approaching that.
And that's why we discuss these things with wonderful guests, great guests like the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan, serves as pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, our resident historian here at, Ask the Pastor, Studio A Bible Study. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for the invitation. Always great.
Thank you, sir. All right, guys, have a great weekend. Be safe. We're back on Monday. We wrap up Acts and more Ask the Pastor. We'll see
Listen
you then.
Listen to the Bible Study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.